listening to the Positive Professional Podcast with your host, me, Tracy Yvonne. This podcast is a weekly conversation about all things mental health, self-care, and wellness. And there'll be sprinkles of positivity, mindfulness, and guided meditations.
Welcome back to Season 7, Episode 22. Today, I'm going back to a conversation that I started in Episode 20. But something significant has happened since that episode. On September 4th, 2026, the murder trial of Lindsey Clancy ended in a mistrial after jurors were unable to reach a unanimous verdict after nearly 40 hours of deliberation. Prosecutors have not yet announced whether they will retry the case. So I want to revisit this, but I'm not interested in retrying Lindsey Clancy on this podcast. I'm interested in something I watched happening outside the courtroom. The women who rallied behind her. Women showed up, women advocated, women discussed postpartum mental illness, women demanded compassion. Women said that mental health care system failed another mother. But some of that advocacy raises an important issue that absolutely deserves attention. Serious postpartum psychiatric illness can be devastating, and maternal mental health care deserves far greater investment and understanding. But as I watched that outpouring, another question kept coming to me. Where was this energy for Latosha Saunders? Where were the crowds? Where was the national sisterhood? Where were the women saying, before you call her evil, let's understand her mental state? Where were the people demanding that her psychiatric history receive serious consideration? And that brings us to today's conversation, because this isn't simply about two criminal cases anymore. This is about race, gender, mental illness, intersectionality, and the limits of sisterhood when race enters the room. Before anything else, I want to acknowledge five children, three of Lindsey Clancy's children and two of Latosha Saunders' children. They cannot be footnotes in conversations about their mothers. Nothing about discussing mental illness, race, gender, or legal responsibility requires us to minimize the fact that five children are dead. Compassion doesn't have to be rationed. We can care about the children. We can question mental health care. We can care about justice. And we can question racial inequities. All of these things can exist simultaneously. So let's establish the facts. Clancy's trial lasted approximately 6 weeks. Her defense argued that she was suffering from postpartum psychosis and lacked criminal responsibility when she killed her three children. Prosecutors argued that her actions were deliberate and that she understood their wrongfulness. The jury ultimately could not reach a unanimous verdict, and the judge, William Sullivan, declared a mistrial. According to Clancy's attorney, the jury was split 11-1 in favor of acquittal, although that characterization comes from the defense rather than an official jury verdict. Outside the courtroom, Clancy had visible supporters. Following the mistrial, some supporters confronted the district attorney during the press conference, accusing him of corruption and calling for justice for Clancy. Now compare that visibility with Latosha Saunders. Many never knew of this case. In August, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court vacated Saunders' two first-degree murder convictions and ordered a new trial. And listen carefully to why. The state's Hyatt Court concluded that excluding relevant medical records concerning Saunders' post-arrest diagnosis and mental health treatment was a prejudicial error. The court wrote that excluding those records deprived her criminal responsibility defense of important medical support. That is significant. And here's another fact worth repeating. Judge William Sullivan presided over Saunders' original trial. And as we all know, he's the judge who presided over Clancy's trial. I'm not presenting the fact as proof that the judge discriminated against Saunders. We do not have evidence to make that claim. However, comma. But the contrast gives us legitimate reason to examine how mental illness, race, gender, media attention, and public empathy operate around these cases. And this is where today's conversation may become uncomfortable. And that's okay, because discomfort and disrespect are not the same thing. I watched women connect with Lindsay Clancy. Many appeared to see themselves in her story, a mother, a healthcare professional, a woman struggling after childbirth, a woman they believed was failed by the mental health care system, and empathy often begins with identification. This could have been me. But here's my question. Why wasn't Latasha Saunders equally imaginable as me? Why wasn't her psychiatric condition capable of generating the same level of curiosity? Why wasn't her suffering simply understood as a woman's mental health issue? And I want to be very clear, the answer cannot simply be that these cases are different. They absolutely are. Saunders' case was not a postpartum psychosis case. The women's histories, diagnoses, circumstances, evidence, and legal proceedings differ, but we're talking about something broader. The public capacity to humanize a mentally ill woman accused of doing something horrific. That is where intersectionality becomes important. Intersectionality helps us to understand that people's experiences aren't shaped by one identity at a time. A Black woman doesn't experience womanhood on Monday and Blackness on Tuesday. Those identities interact. Race, gender, class, motherhood, disability, mental health, economic status. All of those can influence how someone encounters institutions and how institutions respond to them. Research on Black maternal mental health specifically shows that race, gender, pregnancy, socioeconomic circumstances, and social experiences intersect in ways that shape psychological stress and access support. So when we say women need better mental health care, I agree. But then I need us to finish the sentence. Which women? Are we talking about all women? Do Black women receive the same presumption of vulnerability? Are Black women allowed to fall apart? Are they allowed to be fragile? Are their symptoms recognized as illness? Or does society sometimes move more quickly towards angry, aggressive, dangerous, irresponsible, criminal? That's where intersectional mental health conversation begins. And I'm going to share more in the next segment. We need to talk about the mythology surrounding Black women's strength. People say Black women are so strong, and sometimes We receive that as a compliment. But strength becomes dangerous when it turns into an expectation that we should survive everything without breaking. Perhaps when a white woman says, "I'm overwhelmed," society may be more readily hear vulnerability. Perhaps when a Black woman says, "I'm overwhelmed," there is an expectation you'll figure it out. Strength can become invisibility. And if we're going to advocate for women's mental health, we cannot build an advocacy movement where vulnerability itself has a racial image. Mental illness doesn't become more legitimate because the person experiencing it looks familiar to you. And this is where I want to give some historical context. Sometimes American history gets reduced to women fought for the vote and women won the vote in 1920. No, that's incomplete. Black women were absolutely part of the suffrage struggle. They organized, spoke, wrote, marched, and fought for political rights. But Black women also had to confront racism within the women's suffrage movement itself. And after the 19th Amendment prohibited denying the vote on the basis of sex, many Black women, particularly in the South, continued facing poll taxes, literacy tests, intimidation, violence, and other forms of racial voter suppression. The struggle for meaningful voting access continued for decades and culminated in a major federal protections, including the Voting Rights Act of 1965. So I would phrase the historical lesson differently than simply saying the suffrage movement was for white women. But Black women were there, they fought. The more accurate and more powerful truth is the mainstream suffrage movement often failed to practice racial solidarity it demanded around gender. And that matters today, because history teaches us that being marginalized in one area does not automatically prevent someone from participating in the marginalization of another group. I'm going to say that again. Being marginalized in one area does not automatically prevent someone from participating in the marginalization of another group. A woman can experience sexism and still participate in racism. A person can describe themselves as progressive and still have racial blind spots. A person can believe deeply in women's rights and still unconsciously imagine white women when they picture the women who need protecting. That's the uncomfortable part of intersectionality. It asks us to examine not only where we're oppressed, but where we may have privilege. And I also want to talk about something else. Political labels don't automatically eliminate bias. You can call yourself a liberal, progressive, feminist, an ally, an advocate. Those identities may describe your values, but they don't automatically guarantee that you've examined how race shapes your empathy. Sometimes people support equality conceptually, until equality requires them to recognize someone whose life looks very different from theirs. Real allyship isn't, "I support women who remind me of myself." It's, "I'm willing to examine whether my compassion changes when race, class, culture, or social status changes." And that is a much harder standard. I do want to make this distinction very clearly. Mental illness and criminal responsibility are not synonymous. Someone can have a serious psychiatric diagnosis and still be legally responsible for a crime. Someone can also be so psychiatrically impaired that the law concludes they lacked criminal responsibility. That's why courts hear evidence. That's why experts testify. That's why jurors deliberate. So when I'm asking why Saunders didn't receive the same public empathy, I'm not saying, therefore, she should be acquitted. And asking for compassion for Saunders doesn't require taking compassion away from Clancy. That's scarcity thinking. I want a bigger table. If maternal mental health matters, Black maternal mental health matters. If psychiatric evidence matters, it matters when the defendant is Black. If mentally ill women deserve dignity, Black mentally ill women deserve dignity. So here's a reflection I want you all to do. And you don't have to answer this publicly. You don't have to defend yourself. Just sit with it. When you first saw Lindsay Clancy, what did you feel? When you first heard Latosha Saunders' story, what did you feel? Did one woman immediately appear more sympathetic? If so, why? Was it race? Appearance? Profession? Class? The photographs selected by the media? The language used in headlines? The diagnosis, the family narrative, or something you can't immediately identify? That's not an accusation, that's self-examination. Bias isn't always someone consciously saying, I don't like Black women. Sometimes bias is revealed through the people for whom our compassion arrives automatically, and the people who have to prove they deserve it. So as I conclude today's episode, I'm going to wrap this up in our Season 7 framework, completion. Let's complete the idea that advocating for women automatically means every woman is being equally seen. Let's complete performative solidarity. Let's complete the assumption that having progressive values means that we no longer have biases to examine. Reflection. Ask yourself, who receives my empathy automatically? Whose suffering requires more proof before I believe it? When I say I support women's mental health, which women am I picturing? And would my reaction to this story change if the women's race changed? Take a moment and sit with that. Renewal means expanding the circle. Not less compassion for Lindsay Clancy, more consistent compassion, more curiosity about Latosha Saunders, more attention to Black women's mental health, more willingness to challenge systems where psychiatric evidence isn't treated appropriately, and more courage to recognize that solidarity means very little if it disappears at the intersection of race. The mistrial didn't answer every question surrounding Lindsay Clancy. Legally, her case remains unresolved. Prosecutors have yet decided whether or not they're going to retry her. And a status hearing is scheduled for, I think, September 29th. And Latosha Saunders will receive another trial because Massachusetts' highest court determined that important mental health evidence should have not been excluded from the jury's consideration. I want to know if the women with those pink shirts are going to be standing out when that retrial happens. But there's another trial happening outside the courtroom, and it's the trial of our own empathy. And that's the one that I'm asking us to examine today. If thousands of women can mobilize around the mental health of one mother, imagine what becomes possible when that advocacy crosses racial lines. I don't want less compassion for white women. I am not saying that. I want us to ask why Black women so often have to fight harder to receive it. That's intersectionality. That's reflection. And if we're going to do the work and we're willing to do the work, maybe that's where renewal begins. Until next time, take care of your mind, protect your heart, and remember, you are the most important person in your life.
Listening and supporting this podcast, and make sure you're clicking the like and subscribe button. You can also follow me on Twitter and Instagram. Stay safe, be well, and don't forget to be the best version of you.